Well, thanks very much. And I should start by giving the usual Ciceronian preface to get your sympathy, in which I also am working under obligation to Roy, who told me the kinds of things that I ought to be saying. And I've tried to follow him to the letter, both in thinking of this as a workshop, but also in setting out, as he put it, some overview of the evidence, something about what's been written, historiography, and some problems and some possibilities for future research. So what I'm not offering is a paper of my own, but rather a review of where we are and where I've been thinking we might go. In that sense, I'm slightly worried that it's going to be an unpalatable combination of being obvious and idiosyncratic towards the end, so I hope you'll bear with me. The obvious bit, what do we have? Well, a quick overview of the textual material and some linguistic culture, some of which we've encountered this morning. For Anglo-Saxon England, from 597 onwards, we've got letters from the papacy, from Aldhelm, from Boniface, which tell us something about missionary experiences of paganism and about missionary techniques and conversion. From about 600 onwards, we've got royal laws. Didn't know how to illustrate this, so we've got an edition of the royal laws. And these are four texts spanning the 7th into the early 8th centuries, but only preserved for us from the West Saxon and the Kentish courts in southern England. From about 670 onwards, we've also got royal diplomas. Unfortunately for me, they only occur for, again, southern and western England, not for northern England, though we know that they were produced there. Finally, we've also got royal genealogies from the early 8th century preserved in Bede, but also transmitted through some 9th century manuscripts. Together, those royal laws, diplomas, and genealogies offer us some insights into conversion at the royal courts. So the protection that was offered to the church, the impact of the church on court culture, the introduction of a written record, the foundation of monastic houses, the resources that were granted to them, and potentially the attraction to kings and elites of the terms of those foundations. By the 8th century, we get two ecclesiastical texts which might tell us a little bit about lay behaviour. They're the proceedings of ecclesiastical councils and penitentials, principally the penitential of Theodore, some of which are edited in that volume. And they give us an ecclesiastical perception of both ecclesiastical and lay behaviour, but also, fairly obviously, some ideas about how you might correct that lay behaviour. By the early 8th century too, we get histories. The early 8th century Northumbrian and Mercian histories and hagiographies, narratives of paganism, mission, missionaries' conversion and the foundation of monasteries. And what's now being brought into the dialogue on conversion, 10th and 11th century hagiography from the Reform movement, which picks up folkloric elements of belief through the interaction of our clergy with the lay population. Finally, Old English poetry, edited for us there by Sid Bradley. This gives us some sense of the interaction between lay culture, lay aristocratic culture, and Christian culture. So on to our material culture. And to begin with, we've got two types of mortuary ritual which are brought into discussion. First of which is cremation cemeteries from the 5th to the 7th century, representing perhaps hundreds or thousands of cremation burials in which individuals were cremated, their remains were mixed, in some cases with the remains of animals who'd been cremated, and set in containers with symbolic systems, often considered, from the point of view of conversion, to represent migrant communities who were bringing in a potentially non-Christian Germanic belief system with them. Alongside these are inhumation cemeteries, both furnished and unfurnished, from the 5th to the early 8th centuries. These seem to represent populations of about 50 to 100 people in local communities. They probably represent indigenous peoples and migrants, and they allow us to reconstruct kin groups within the cemeteries, projecting status identities such as gender and age cycles through the deposition of grave goods. By looking at the patterns of mortuary ritual, people have been able to construct a sense of changes in social status, or at least the projection of social status through time. By the later 6th century, we're getting a greater wealth differential within cemeteries and between cemeteries. Some individuals are given more expensive burials and greater investment in the mortuary ritual, and we get the development of barrow cemeteries, both at flat cemeteries and isolated barrow burials. And this is just the cemetery at Wasperton in Warwickshire, to show by the later 6th century the idea that we're getting, within a flat cemetery, a group of potential barrow burials around the edges. From those grave goods, we might be able to get some insights into belief, which I'll come back to. Our cremation urns and some of the items that are deposited in them and in inhumation cemeteries are clearly marked with symbolic patterns. The question of whether we can interpret those symbolic patterns remains open. In this case, animals or swastikas, which have been in some of the literature identified with Thunor as a giver of lightning in our later written sources. During the 7th century, the well-studied final phase, so-called final phase, in which Mediterranean items, Mediterranean culture, a smaller range of items are deposited in graves, along with some items which might bear Christian iconography. And finally, in the 8th century, the end of grave goods. What does this tell us about changes in lay belief? Settlement archaeology. Again, this seems to confirm the size of our local communities who are being converted. Between the 5th and the 7th century, the number of local communities we might identify with about 5 to 10 buildings, perhaps representing populations of 50 to 100 people again, composed perhaps of 5 to 10 households, which would sit quite nicely with our cemetery evidence. What we see in the late 6th century, alongside our differential wealth in cemeteries and the development of barrow burial, is a greater settlement hierarchy. So we see increased planning at some sites, the development of halls, as here at Yeavering, the development of some foci potentially for assembly, greater planning, the axial layout, and the reuse of prehistoric remains. And finally, I guess with settlement archaeology from the 650s onwards, we've got the introduction of our monastic sites, a number of which have been very well excavated now. And this is Weymouth and Jarrow and the reconstructions of them sitting at the estuaries, and the introduction of a whole new settlement pattern, churches, communal buildings, refectories and dormitories, workshops, but also ancillary buildings. So these offer a potential for us to look at the impact on settlement patterns of conversion. Alongside the settlement archaeology, we might talk about landscape archaeology. Difficult for me to define this, but work that's been done both by John Blair and Sarah Semple, as we've seen this morning, looking at the landscape of paganism. John Blair, in a very good article, has written about potential pagan temple sites, which consist of these square enclosures, sometimes on prehistoric barrows with single standing posts, some of which may be incorporated into buildings. And this, he says, might represent our pagan temple sites. But Sarah Semple, in looking at sites which are identified by the Old English speakers as potential pagan sites, has argued for sites which are of much longer duration, which are open landscape sites, which are used from potentially the prehistoric through to the 5th and 6th centuries, and which might be used for a range of ritual activities. Finally, in terms of our material culture, stone sculpture. From probably the 670s onwards, with the introduction of stone building, we get the introduction too of stone sculpture. First, probably architectural sculpture, as seen in this impost from Weymouth Jarrow, and these fantastic throne finials from Weymouth Jarrow. Probably followed by the introduction of name stones used for monumentalising burials, and finally by the introduction of the plain standing stone cross, which develops into deep relief carving. And finally, in this rather obvious review, I'm afraid, of what we have, the linguistic culture, onomastics, naming. From the preservation of the names of days and the names of months within the Old English language, we can see, at least by the time those names are being used, the idea of a Germanic pantheon. And Bede, in his commentary on the temple, understands the month names to reflect a series of pagan seasonal rituals. This is a text of the early 8th century. In place names, as represented on this map, we have a range of sites which are identified by Old English speakers as pagan sites. In particular, we've got sites which are associated with the pagan gods, the Germanic pantheon, but also sites identifying apparent temple structures, Hera and Wayo, some of which are accompanied by the term Ingas, the followers of the people of the folk of this area. These, however, are again regionally restricted. It's interesting to me that they don't occur in the areas that I work on in northern England, and this is something we might come back to. Great, okay, so much for an obvious review of what there is. The question is, what can we do with it? And here I'd like you to have a look at the handout which was put into your packs. Hopefully you've got it to hand. What I've done on the handout is simply to set out some of what I think is the most significant historiography, so that I can very quickly summarise some historiographical patterns and approaches that have been applied. Now, it seems to me the key factor in how people have combined, or whether they've combined, textual and material culture is the dominant position of Bede's narrative of conversion, which we met this morning, as a problem for Anglo-Saxonists. So it may be seen as a very good thing to people who don't have it. Originally, the status of Bede as a historian meant that his narrative could largely be reproduced with a little bit of adjustment and the addition of information from other sources that survived alongside. And Frank Stenton's chapter in his Anglo-Saxon England and John Godfrey's The Anglo-Saxon Church are excellent examples of this. What they did was to supplement Bede with those day, month and place names, the letters, hagiography, laws and diplomas. And largely, they reflected Bede's assumptions about missionary activity as the targeting of royal courts, a rational argument for conversion, and the building of an institutional church which went through a golden age in the 7th century and then a period of decline reflected in that material we've got in the 8th century for lay behaviour and ecclesiastical behaviour, the penitentials and the ecclesiastical canons. From the 1960s onwards, I think best represented by James Campbell's work, there's a new criticism of Bede's narrative. And initially what happens is that people identify what's missing from Bede's narrative. That he doesn't talk very much about British and Frankish missionaries explicitly. That he doesn't talk very much about the growth of ecclesiastical wealth, the spread of monasticism, or the prominence of some churchmen. And alongside that, people started to look at his biblical and moral programme. So people like Wallace Hadrill, Marcus, and Alan Thacker began to look at the biblical models that Bede had used and his scriptural commentary from the early 8th century to see the kind of moral agenda that Bede was pursuing. As a result of this, I think there was a key insight, which is that our textual culture is not a straightforward narrative of conversion. Rather, it's a product of the social process of conversion. And we can come back to this as a problem, but is creating a narrative of conversion itself a moment in conversion, both individually and collectively? Sociologists Snow and McCulloch, who did a review of the sociology of conversion, said really the only way to measure this is by individual and collective narrative. There is no other measure of whether someone has converted to a new religion. Well, what this produced, this insight, was new narratives of conversion. So initially, new reviews of royal motivations using comparative and anthropological approaches. And what we saw there was a consideration of all of the attractions that Christianity might have posed for kings. But it's resulted in, I think, a very good article by Damien Tyler, who is sceptical of the idea that kings straightforwardly converted because Christianity was attractive. So we're starting to see scepticism about the idea that this was something that was attractive at royal courts. We saw new characterizations of Christian culture. So by abandoning the Golden Age and the decline, that paradigm, and reading against the grain of the histories, using the Old English poetry from the 10th century, people like Patrick Wormald, James Campbell, and Richard Fletcher have argued that conversion represents a fusion of lay aristocratic and Christian culture, and have even gone so far as to suggest that our converts are lay and ecclesiastical aristocrats, may not have looked very different in lots of respects in the 7th and 8th centuries, and their sites may be indistinguishable. We've also seen new interdisciplinary assessments of changes in lay belief, so the material culture has become much more prominent. To begin with paganism, we've seen a new emphasis on looking at local cemeteries and starting with local communities to identify ritual specialists on the ground. So Audrey Meany identified a range of items in burials which might be understood as having amuletic properties. And she argued, in fact, that gender identities are being projected through those amulets and their use in graves. But moreover, that there were some individuals, almost always females, and perhaps one per generation in any cemetery, who were buried with an amuletic kit bag, an orb, animal bones and teeth, and that these could be connected with our penitential literature, which identifies women as particularly involved in rites of magic and healing. And Knussel and Ripley have raised the prospect that some individuals whose gender cannot be ascertained might represent shamanists who were able to communicate with the spirit world. We've also seen attempts to identify pagan rites through the material record. So Howard Williams, I think, has produced an excellent article looking at cremation as a ritual of transformation by considering not only the cremated remains, but the animal bones that go in, the animal imagery that's produced on cremation urns, and considering this as a potentially anthropomorphic rite that seeks to bind the souls of animals and humans together through cremation. We've also seen Sarah Semple's work on identifying new types of ritual foci from the material record alone, and thinking about those ritual landscapes which we've heard about. And finally, in the pre-Christian period, there have been new studies of the interaction between religious belief and social status. So Tanya Dickinson has been looking very fruitfully at Ceylon Style 1, which may represent some kind of mythology, and looking at the items which depict that mythology and their deposition in cemeteries as ways of constructing a new elite identity in the 6th century. And all of that's been put together in the volume on Signals of Belief, which you can go away and have a look at if you haven't already. In addition to that, in the Christian period, we've had some fantastic new work on charting shifts in lay culture, in lay belief through the material record. An earlier generation thought that the final phase and the end of grave goods might be straightforwardly an index of conversion and Christianisation. But work by Buller, Geek, Burnell and James and Guy Halsall on the final phase and the end of grave goods has tended to downplay that, or at least to complicate that picture. The church apparently wasn't very concerned with the way people were buried. Processual and post-processual interpretative frameworks have placed more emphasis on grave goods as a projection of social status and have worried about the degree to which we can think about belief from grave goods. And continental comparisons have raised problems about potential parallels on the continent, similar processes that are occurring even though conversion had happened at a much earlier point. All of this, I think, has resulted in a series of very interesting new syntheses. And I just want to end the historiography by briefly summarising what they've got to say. John Blair's looked at the Anglo-Saxon church, and he's considered, using that archaeological background, the social context of the construction of an institutional church and the impact it might have on Lear belief. So, crudely put, he's suggesting that those changes in mortuary ritual and settlements might represent a new kind of social stratification in the later 6th century, and that status being projected through access to continental items might be a context for, if you like, the process of infiltration that was described for us earlier today. He's also suggested that existing social organisation, perhaps seen through that mortuary ritual, might be a seedbed for the reception of some aspects of Christian culture over others. So kinship being particularly compatible with religious communities, with monasticism. Female religious specialists perhaps producing a greater emphasis on female abbots in the Anglo-Saxon church in the 7th century. And the use of Christian objects as amulets to replace those amulets that were being used to project gender identity at an earlier date. Marilyn Dunn has made a very interesting argument that conversion might be understood as a compromise between non-Christian imagistic worship, a belief in multiple souls, drawing on the idea of cremation as a transformation of the soul, and rituals to ensure the safe separation of those souls, and a new kind of religion, Christian doctrinal worship, a belief in single souls, and rituals for the post-mortem salvation of those souls. And she's wanted to look at the development of ideas about the afterlife as a way of compromise between these two views of the soul. And finally, Richard Hoggett has been seeking new ways to measure conversion through the archaeological record in East Anglia. And he would argue that the end of cremation should, for those communities, be seen as a moment of conversion. That inhumation with multiple Christian objects may at least identify some individual Christians in the 7th century, and that the construction of cemeteries at settlements might reflect Christian concerns for the salvation of the dead, so the bringing in of the dead into the community of the living. Well, that's where we are, and all I want to do is to identify five issues that are certainly at the forefront of my mind, and that and some possible ways in which we might approach them. And the first of these is the social context of conversion. So we can see these changes in mortuary ritual, a new wealth differential, a new settlement hierarchy. But what does this represent? Does it represent for us the first post-Roman social stratification in these territories, in the Anglo-Saxon territories, and the first emergence of kings with wider authorities? Or does it simply represent a new level of social stratification, or indeed the introduction of a new social system, that is, the social system we can see operating in the 7th century, in which kings receive warrior aristocrats from local communities into their courts and train them and deploy them as administrative officials? Whatever the case, what part does that social context play in conversion to Christianity? Is it that Christianity is seen as a way to legitimise royal power and a new elite? Or is it simply that it offers new utility within that social system? And where does the line lie between acknowledging that social context for conversion and reducing religion to a social epiphenomenon? So what do we do about the difference between our narratives of conversion, which depict individual encounters, and this great social context? And how do we incorporate it without ignoring all of the intellectual decisions that people were making on the ground? And I think the solution to all of this has to be comparative studies with the Irish material. So I'd love to hear what the archaeological context for Irish conversion is, because I don't know, but also with the continental archaeological material. A second issue is the nature of Anglo-Saxon paganism. So we've got these fantastic studies of ritual on the ground and the variety that Sarah Semple was talking about in the last session. But we've also got evidence for objects which may or may not be depicting the attributes of pagan gods in the Germanic pantheon. We've got, by the Christian period, the development of place names reflecting that Germanic pantheon. And we've got these potential sites where there are more focused ritual events going on. And my question is, what are the objects of worship? Do we have a variety of gods? Numina in the landscape, sites, watery sites, groves, coexisting with more formalised personified gods, and who worships what and where. With the loci of worship, what's happening in the kind of areas that I work on, where we don't have the records of these place names and we don't yet have the archaeology of pagan temples? So I think the extension of those studies across the English landscape. And what's the relationship between pre-Christian religious cult and social status? So I think following up the work Tanya Dickinson's been doing and thinking again about the relationship between our aristocracy, our kings and our aristocracy, and this so-called Germanic pantheon that comes in the 7th and 8th century in the sources, and the degree to which this is a reality of the 6th century or just of Christian projections. I also think, thirdly, that we might consider the social and political dynamics of conversion. Following up Damien Tyler's work, which tends to be sceptical about the role of kings in choosing to convert straightforwardly, and following up Chris Wickham's observations that Anglo-Saxon kings might be, relatively speaking, compared to their continental counterparts, under-resourced in terms of the food renders that are at their disposal, we might wonder whether aristocratic social strategy rather than royal attractions to Christianity underlies conversion to Christianity. And we could take a cue from Matinis and Hans Hummer, who've looked at warrior aristocratic king groups and social strategy on the continent as a context for the building of the church. Some things that we might be able to do with the material and textual evidence. Well, our archaeology reveals for us gender distinctions and age cycles, and some individuals will not have been able to embody the modes of authority at the particular ages that they were supposed to, or indeed the gender identities that they were supposed to. To what extent did kin groups see Christianity as an opportunity to bring in new gender identities, new kind of ascetic masculinity and femininity, new opportunities for people to pursue social status? We can see from the texts what kind of kin groups were operating and what sorts of instabilities and problems they might face. And if we put those two things together, we might be able to consider the social process. So the first baptism of individuals in the 620s onwards who would grow up to be Christians. The idea that the period of their maturity was one in which there were both aristocratic pagan kin groups and aristocratic Christian kin groups, and that kings had to react to that political environment. But that by the time they reach 18 or 25 in the mid-7th century, it became clear the benefits of conversion as a social strategy for aristocratic kin groups, and we cease to see apostasy. We start to see everybody pursuing investment in the church as a social strategy. And the idea, following up some of the concepts on ritual from this morning, that might coincide with heroic acts of rupture, moments at the royal court where individuals stood up to the old belief system to emphasise the new public moral code that was operating. And I'm thinking here of narratives that Bede describes from about the mid-7th century of individuals like Aidan standing up to Oswini at the royal court when he's asked why he's given away a horse. And he roundly tells Oswini that he shouldn't value a horse over the life of even a poor peasant. These kinds of moments which might legitimise the new social system. If we take that through, I think fourthly, there's a current historiographical problem within Anglo-Saxon work over the relationship between lay and ecclesiastical identity. Henry Meyer Harting pointed out in a Jarrow lecture on Bede and social status that, at least in the Benedictine rule and in Bede, conversion to Christianity and particularly entry to the church entailed a radical rejection of aristocratic status systems, the inversion of a lot of those aristocratic ideals. But Patrick Wormald's work, followed up, has blurred the line between lay and aristocratic identity. And I think we might use studies of the text and material culture to try to reinvigorate that issue. We can think about the way in which the laws set up a new legal status for individuals who enter the church. They undergo a kind of civil death and become subject to a new legal position. And in small face-to-face communities, this is going to have real significance. We can see from the hagiography the kind of monastic education people had and the offices where they would have been subjected to Christian culture. And we can think about how that might have been reinforced and reflected in the archaeology of monastic sites. So it might help them to understand estuaries and harbours as representations of the religious life, the journey through life to death, and the harbour as a site for the monastic life between the chaos of the sea and the land. The space that they operated in might be divided up according to your position in the religious hierarchy. Bede describes the hanging of paintings in the monastic church between apparently literate religious figures and an illiterate audience, and says they still have utility for that illiterate audience. We also see the burials of apparently monastic individuals on one side of a corridor running up the site at Wearmouth, and the burial of apparently a lay community on the other side. So every day you're walking through a space which divides your old and your new identities. And we see this being embodied in a new material culture at these sites. And finally, the question of the observation of changes in lay belief. I think here we need to do more still to consider what the difference is between social identities projected through grave goods and religious culture. And I thought particularly that the work that Sarah Semple and Andrew Reynolds have done in observing long-term changes in the cultural identity of burrows and the development of new locations for execution cemeteries offers a way of seeing a Christianized landscape which doesn't straightforwardly require us to connect grave goods with the beliefs of an individual. But I leave that open to debate, so thank you very much.